Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Today, we continue our series of conversations with the candidates with Harry Dunn, a Democrat who's running for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. The incumbent, John Sarbanes, will retire from the House of Representatives next January. The 3rd District includes all of Howard County as well as parts of Anne Arundel and Carroll counties. Harry Dunn came to national prominence as one of the Capitol police officers who protected the Capitol on January 6, 2021, during the insurrection intended to block the certification of the 2020 election. He testified before the January 6 special committee, and he wrote a book about his harrowing experience on January 6 called Standing My Ground: A Capitol Police Officer's Fight for Accountability and Good Trouble After January 6th. Harry Dunn served on the Capitol Police Force for 15 years from 2008 until 2023. He holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Health Science from James Madison University, where he played on the JMU football team and helped lead that team to a national championship. He grew up in Prince George's County. He lives in Silver Spring. He is 40 years old and a divorced father of a young daughter. Harry Dunn joins me in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Mr. Dunn, it's great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Tom, thanks for having me on. I'm so glad to be here right now.
So take us back to January 6, 2021, because that was really, you know, seems to be the impetus and the animating force behind your run for Congress. Where were you stationed? Give us an overview of that horrible day for you.
Sure. It's hard to believe it's 3 years, more than 3 years since that. It still feels very fresh for me. And also, you see a lot of people that are campaigning, especially on the Republican side, are campaigning off of the promises to, you know, kind of erase that day. But on January 6th, I reported for duty, just like I had been. And over 15 years at the Capitol, I think it's safe to say I oversaw or was part of security forces for over 1,000-plus protests. So I anticipated just being another day, possibly with some civil disobedience and a couple of arrests. But never did I, in my wildest dreams, think that what happened that day would happen. And, you know, my post was on the east side of the Capitol originally, on the top of the Senate steps that oversaw the plaza, but directly in front of the Supreme Court on the Capitol side. And then when I heard on the radio, there was so much commotion on the radio from the day just in general, but I heard a familiar voice on the radio to give a dire call. And you could just hear the sense of urgency and the sense of terror and fright in that person's voice, screaming for more units and backup. And that was when we learned that the initial breach of the police line happened. And I responded over to the west side, and I got to my first glimpse of the crowd. And it was like a scene out of a movie. It was something I'd never seen before. It was just violence and chaos and Trump flags and America flags just flying, Confederate flags just flying, while those individuals who were Trump supporters were attacking police officers.
And they attacked you. You were involved in fights, and you're a big dude. I mean, yeah. You know, you were an offensive lineman in college.
You know, so I was fortunate that I did not suffer the levels of physical attacks that a lot of my coworkers did. I did catch bear spray and pepper spray, and you know, contact with those. But as far as the actual physical beating that my coworkers taken, I was fortunate enough not to endure those. And I think one of the reasons too is I had a rifle, a long gun that day, so my positioning was an overwatch position. However, when officers who were in the midst of the fray and the I won't call it a scuffle, the all-out attack on law enforcement, when they were overwhelmed and they could no longer fight due to chemical irritants being sprayed directly in their face or being bludgeoned or beaten with flag poles with sharpened points on them. And, you know, there was a fence and they tore apart the fence and were using it to attack officers with. And I was, my role in that capacity was helping decontaminate them, give them aid, flush their eyes out with water so they could get back in the fight.
Can you describe the kind of general political predilections of people on the Capitol Police Force? Is there, an overt effort to be nonpartisan, most people are kind of conservative, most people kind of liberal? Is there a way of generalizing in any productive way?
Sure. Well, we try to. And Capitol Police, the Capitol Police is not like most other police forces. Our job is literally to protect the politicians that make up the Congress of this country. And we see how divided politics is. So the police officers have the very daunting task of being able to remain nonpartisan and protect members of Congress. I mean, it's even written in our general orders. I've resigned from the Capitol Police. I'm no longer there. But it was written in the general orders that, we remain neutral in, political stances, and we don't engage in those things. And throughout my career, I never really bought politics into doing my job. I mean, however, you're still Americans, you're still humans, you still have those discussions with people. And, the Fraternal Order of Police, that the Capitol Police is, belongs under that umbrella, they endorsed Donald Trump in, the last two presidential elections, not leading up to this year. I don't know if they have yet or not. But so while we do our job, we still are individuals that still have political leanings one way or the other.
And in terms of, you've written about this, you testified in front of the Jan 6 committee and elsewhere about the racial epithets that you were subjected to, the emotional and physical toll that this took on you and your colleagues, and certainly some of your colleagues had an emotional toll that in some cases ended up in suicide. It's just it's a horrible, horrible moment in American history. But you got to know people in the Congress. You got to people know in the House and know them in the House and the Senate, because you saw them every day. You knew them by name. They knew you by name. Yet some of them have now taken a political posture that is consonant with Mr. Trump's malicious fiction that this wasn't that big a deal. It wasn't an insurrection. It wasn't a riot. There were people there who were, acting peacefully, etc. How does that weird dimension fit into your motivation to run for office yourself?
That's one of the things that really makes me, that I struggled with the most and that made me really angry, is when I testified, I said that people said that we or the media tried to make January 6th political. When in fact is, January 6th was strictly about the political. You can't take politics out of what the people that were there on January 6th said. They were there because they thought the election was stolen. So they were there on a political sense anyway, with marching orders from the former president. But looking back, like you said, I met several members of Congress, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, people I agree with, people I don't agree with. And we became, friendly or cordial to each other. This is prior to January 6th. But to see the response from lawmakers, I like to say in the MAGA faction of the Republican Party, because let's be clear, it wasn't all Republicans. I mean, Adam Cheney and Liz,
Adam Kinzinger.
Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney are the two people that come to mind that were thrusted from the party because they had the courage, the decency, the moral compass to stand up and push back. And look where that got them. So I don't say it's a Republican Democrat. It's the MAGA faction that is doing this, led by Donald Trump. And it's so frustrating because nobody with a right mind, in the right state of mind, can look at what happened that day and describe that as acceptable. And so many people in that faction tried to do that. And this is not about the election was stolen. It wasn't that. They physically attacked police officers and they breached the United States Capitol, desecrated it, walked around chanting to hang Mike Pence and to kill Nancy Pelosi. And their goal that day was to stop the certification of the election. Those are all facts, and those are indisputable. We can't we're not going to debate, you know, you could debate their intentions, their motives, all that stuff. But what actually happened, that's not up for debate. That's why I get so frustrated when I hear reporters or even in the court saying allegedly. We watched it all unfold. It was nothing alleged about it. Everybody saw what happened. And that brought me to this moment right now, especially when before Mr. Sarbanes even announced that he was resigning from Congress, I had been pounding the pavement, so to speak, for accountability and the preservation of democracy, even just as an officer. But then when there became an opportunity to have the seat at the table, it made sense just as a continuation of public service that I've been doing for the last 15 years.
You grew up in Prince George's. You live in Silver Spring. That's not actually in the 3rd District.
Correct.
So why the 3rd District to run?
Well, it was an open seat, and I'm very familiar with the district. Just on a logistics standpoint, I think from the edge of the district to my house is 12 minutes or something. So I spend a lot of time in the district. My sister lives in the district. One of the first jobs I had took me all through Annapolis. So I'm very familiar with the district. I see the individuals in the communities, in the grocery stores, at the gyms, Costco on a Saturday. But it's just, you know, I know the people. These lines were drawn by politicians, but those lines don't define what communities are.
Do you plan to move to the district?
Yes, I do. Yes.
You'll move out of Silver Spring if you're elected.
Now that I've resigned from Capitol Police, I have the ability now to move into the district.
What do you think the key is to restoring bipartisanship, cooperation? I mean, I've talked to dozens of candidates for your office as well as other offices throughout this state. And almost everybody says, I want to work across the aisle. I want to talk to people. I want to get to know them. I want to have relationships. And I want to make a difference by moving forward together and finding common ground. But common ground is such a rare piece of real estate in the Congress of the United States. What, in your view, is the key to restoring a sense of cooperation and bipartisanship?
My entire life, I think, since the beginning of my cognitive thoughts in my mind as a child, I've always believed in and belong to something bigger than yourself, whether that was being a team. The first team sport I played was soccer as a child, and then growing up to play basketball and continuing my being a football player, just being team-oriented. And I think that was instilled in me by my parents. My grandfather was an Army veteran. My father is an Air Force veteran. So just the idea of service and just the belonging of the being a part of something bigger than yourself and being accountable to somebody other than just yourself is something that's been instilled in me. And I think I have a leg up on, you know, anybody in this race right now with the relationships that I already have with members of Congress, not just Democrats or people that are, but, you know, the support of people like Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney.
But also with some people who basically deny what happened on January 6th.
Correct. Yeah. So I'm able to have those conversations with individuals on the other side of the aisle to bring a common sense approach to it. Because, like I said, I've been there. I was there. And this is even dating back to years before January 6th. You know, even at the former speaker, Leader McCarthy, I have the relationships with those individuals, and I don't foresee an issue being able to work across the aisle. And I note that on January 6th, 3 years ago, and I worked and protected members of Congress who downplayed what I went through, me and my coworkers went through, even 3 years after it happened. So I revere the institution. I believe it's not about the person that's occupying the seat of Congress, but it's the protection of that seat. And that's what enabled me to continue to serve the people, my country, and to protect members of Congress who I knew were bigots that fanned the flames that started all of this.
Does the fact that you haven't had any specific legislative experience, you've never had held elective office.
Sure.
One of the other contenders in this 22-person field running for the Democratic nomination in the 3rd District is State Senator Sarah Elfrith. She's, in her time in Annapolis as a state senator, passed 84 bills. That's a lot of legislation to move. The fact that you haven't had any direct legislative experience, should that be concerned?
You know,
to voters.
That's fantastic that she's done all of that. She's very accomplished. But let's be clear. I'm not a career politician. A lot of the people in this race are. I'm a regular American citizen who is a career public servant. And I have seen at the Capitol so many people that go to Congress for the wrong reasons. They don't go there to represent the people. They go there with their own agendas, grandstanding to get a sound bite, to appease the leader of the party, which now is Donald Trump, which is more apparent more now than it's ever been. But let's be clear, my experience is as a public servant, and that's what I believe a member of Congress's job is to be a public servant. Like I said, I don't go to Congress with an agenda. Now, I'm a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat. Those are the principles and values that I stand on. So that will definitely influence the choices I make. But my job is to be a voice for the people of the 3rd District. That's it. Bring those concerns to the halls of Congress and make sure they are represented. And I will be a fighter for them more than anybody in this race right now.
Former Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn is a candidate to fill the 3rd District congressional seat, which will be vacated when Representative John Sarbanes retires next year. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, you are welcome to join us. If you have a question for Mr. Dunn, 410-662-8780. You can email us midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, my guest is the author and former Baltimore Sun columnist, Kevin Cowherd. He's written several books for young readers. His latest novel tells a really funny, suspenseful story for adults about the quirky subculture of people who work out together. It's called The Gym. We'll talk about the book, and we'll talk sports with Kevin Cowherd tomorrow here on Midday. And if you've just joined us today, we're continuing our series of conversations with the candidates with Harry Dunn, a former Capitol Police officer who is running for Congress to represent Maryland's 3rd Congressional District. That district is currently represented by John Sarbanes, who is not seeking re-election. It includes all of Howard County and parts of Anne Arundel and Carroll County as well. You are welcome to join our conversation with Harry Dunn, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. So the dysfunction of Congress is something that is sort of most immediately associated with Congress. The Washington Post has articles just this morning about a growing tide of vacating the speakership. Marjorie Taylor Greene is picking up adherence to her efforts to depose Speaker Mike Johnson. The House voted almost 750 times last year and passed like 27 bills. I mean, they don't agree on anything.
Yeah.
What does success look like to you? You talk about restoring democracy. You talk about the threat to democracy. That's in a way kind of a abstract notion. What is actual success? If you are actually elected 4 years from now, what do you hope will have happened?
Let's be clear. I don't believe that anybody, whether from this district or across the whole country, one person is going to go to Congress and fix it. But we do need good people in there, that realize what's at stake, and two, are committed to being steadfast in restoring the American people's trust in those institutions that show fighters. Because who in their right mind would jump into this dysfunction that you just described so well? Who in their right mind is going to willingly go jump headfirst into it? Somebody that believes that it's worth fighting for. There are a lot of issues that I want to, you know, like I said in the last segment, I don't come to Congress with an agenda, but there's so many things that I could believe that I could be an effective ambassador for in Congress. I've talked about mental health. I've talked about wellness, and I think that's one of the things that we need to continue to have on the front lines, the discussions of to bring to the forefront, because those are the type of things that affect anybody, no matter what your political affiliation is. And I think that that's what we need to do as lawmakers. We need to find things that I believe there's so many more things that we have in common than we do have different, that we have differences. And I think that we need to focus on some of those things to start to get results, to get the ball moving and be like, wait, we actually can work together when we have our eyes on the prize about making people's lives better. Also, my experience as a police officer, criminal justice reform, to continue those conversations moving forward. As you can remember, Cory Booker and Tim Scott were working together to come to an agreement on legislation about police reform. The George Floyd Justice and Policing Act passed the House, and it just stalled in the Senate, which many bills tend to do. They couldn't come to an agreement. Cory Booker and Tim Scott couldn't come to an agreement, so the conversation stopped. But you know what didn't stop? The need for police reform. And that's one of the things I hope to jumpstart when I get into Congress, especially having the expertise of being a police officer for the last 15 years.
So for mental health, police reform, is this what you are hearing from constituents in the 3rd District? Because the other thing about congressional districts, they're not huge, but they're not teeny either.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, and the folks in, you know, Western Howard County are going to have perhaps different priorities, different interests, and different needs than the people in Anne Arundel County. You've got to balance that, because you're still talking about, what, 700 and something thousand people.
Yeah, and that's, you know what, that's a great point that you just make, but the thing, everybody might not have that as a priority, but those are some of the things that I am interested in too. Like I said, but it's not me, it's what the constituents want. And the overarching theme, that no matter who I talk to, whether you said Western Howard or, and it doesn't matter, is the fight and the preservation of democracy. So that's what I am going to be there, a constant reminder. And if somebody has the stomach to go watch these congressional hearings that are going on in the right, they are attempting, the MAGA faction, to silence and eliminate any concern that democracy is at stake. Even with women's reproductive rights, every single presidential candidate had a proposed federal abortion ban. And now they're pivoting, and because they're seeing how widely unpopular that has been. And why is that? Because they have fighters in Congress and on the ground that are pushing back against that messaging and saying, no way, this is not what our voters want. And that's what I would do, just be a fighter and a voice for the people of this district based on what they want, what they tell me, what are the things that I'm hearing.
In terms of John Sarbanes, who's been a very popular, congressman for however many years it's been now, would you expect any major departure from his general political philosophical stance, particularly when it comes to in terms of democracy? He's been very much in the forefront of voting rights, et cetera.
That's actually quite the opposite of a departure from it. I plan to lean onto it even more and to continue being a champion for that. I released a 10-page plan about my plan to continue that fight. I also am proud to announce the In Citizens United endorsement. That's one of the things that he really fought for. Getting big money, dark money out of politics.
Citizens United is the Supreme Court case in 2013.
End
Citizens United.
End Citizens United is the organization that is fighting for to remove Citizens United. But that's one of the things that I'm very proud of. My campaign is grassroots funded only. I don't have any contributions from these big corporate political corporations. I don't believe they are people, and I think that they shouldn't be able to buy an election or buy influence in an election.
Your campaign announced $3.7 million so far for the last reporting period. A lot of that money came from outside of Maryland.
Sure.
I mean, you are, you know, a nationally known figure. Should that be of concern to anybody in the 3rd District?
I'm glad that you said that, because a lot of that support came from in Maryland, too. Over 5,500 donors in state and over 2,000 in district. So it's not, you know, I have a national profile. I'm not going to run away from that. It's and that's another thing. I am very blessed to be in the situation that I am now, that I don't have to accept corporate money, because to get your message out, it costs money. Thankfully, mine has been all grassroots funded. And I believe going forward, that's what we're going to need. And like I said, I'm blessed to be in this position where people know who I am. But it's also encouraging that they support me. They support my message. They support what I'm doing, which is, it reaffirms what I'm doing. It's not insane. It's not in vain. So I'm happy to keep on pushing and, you know, being a voice for the people.
Harry Dunn is running for the Democratic nomination in the 3rd District to be a member of the House of Representatives to succeed John Sarbanes. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. Let's talk about a couple of specific issues.
You
mentioned police reform. How about public safety and crime, criminal justice, high on the minds of voters when they go to the polls to elect local leaders as well as national leaders? What is the federal, the proper federal role in policing, in public safety, in encouraging, you know, safer streets?
So, you know, everybody, no matter who you are, no matter where you live, has the right to feel safe. That's first and foremost. And, you know, sure, we can look at the statistics that suggest that crime is down. But in reality, is people's feelings and what they feel, their perceived notion about, I don't feel safe in my community, is what matters. And I am a root cause type person. I don't believe in just throwing a police officer at a situation, removing a bad guy, and that's it. I think we need to get to the root causes of these issues where crime, one of the number one indicators of high crime, is poverty levels. So high poverty is going to translate to high crime. So I think we need to look at that, create opportunities for individuals to be productive, contributing members of their communities to society, create opportunities for them. A lot of police departments, when you talk about the federal government's role in it, a lot of police departments rely on federal funding through different accreditations and things like that. And I believe the government has the right to withhold. I'm not suggesting in any capacity we're defunding the police. In fact, I think it's the opposite. I think we need to fund our police and put them in the best positions for them to be successful. Whether that means putting more social workers out there, more counselors out there, so they can respond to situations and instances that police officers may not be the best skill, may not have the best skill set to be equipped to respond to. And that's what I think that we need to continue to do, is study, listen to our police officers, listen to our communities, and then find out the best ways that we can put them in a position through funding, in the position for them to be successful, because great police officers are needed in these great communities.
Let's talk about immigration.
Yes.
Which is, of course, now highly interlaced with even foreign policy,
yeah,
because aid to Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, held up because of an immigration bill that passed the Senate. After months of negotiation, Senator Lankford, a very conservative member of the Senate, worked out a compromise with Senate Democrats. They passed it, and now it's dead on arrival in the House, as so many other things are. Do you support the Lankford proposals? It's a very conservative,
sure,
approach to immigration, having, you know, leaning heavily on tightening asylum conditions, tightening border security. There's another bill that Speaker Johnson has proposed, HB1, an immigration bill that takes a different tack. But where are you when it comes to those pieces of legislation specifically?
Well, let's back up for a second. And I'm glad that you said that Senator Lankford, very conservative, was able to negotiate a bipartisan bill that was dead on arrival in the House. Why was it dead on arrival in the House? Because Donald Trump said no. And that's what the type of power that Donald Trump has over this faction of the Republican Party. Because if Donald Trump didn't have any input, then that would be law right now, as I agree that it should be. We have to do something about our immigration system. And I just think that just goes back to the overarching issue that we need people in Congress that are willing to put the people above party, this partisan politics stuff. And that's why I'm appreciative of the work that Mr. Lankford was able to do with Democrats. That is what Congress should look like. When you asked me earlier, what does success look like? That's what success looks like. Navigating tough issues, knowing that I'm not going to get everything that I want and knowing that they aren't going to get everything they want. But the ultimate goal is to make it successful for the American people. So that's what success looks like to me. Going back to answer that question, that's a great example of it. But I do support that. And the political grandstanding that is going on in the House, Speaker Johnson introducing a bill with no bipartisan support. So it's literally my way or the highway versus what happened in the Senate, which I think is how we should continue to legislate going forward.
What should the U.S. position be towards Ukraine?
Aid. Fund Ukraine. A threat, you know, Russia's aggression towards Ukraine won't stop there. We need to stand with Ukraine and provide them the assistance that they need to withstand Putin's brutal attack on their country and their democracy.
Do you have an opinion about Speaker Johnson's apparent strategy now, which is to divide up the bills that the Senate passed for foreign aid, which included, you know, an umbrella bill that included Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan, and then some national security measures as well? He's going to do them one at a time.
I don't believe so. I just believe he should take it up as he received it. And look, that's one can only assume his thought process behind that. But you know what it is? It's to, like you just said, what you mentioned earlier, Marjorie Taylor Greene, is to keep people like her happy so they can have a say no. She's made it clear that she doesn't want to support Ukraine. You know, she's made that 100% clear.
And so, if you could have a conversation with her or someone else who holds that position, because she's not the only one in the Republican
sure.
Party who thinks that abandoning Ukraine is perfectly fine as a foreign
but
policy.
But let's be clear, initiative. She may not be the only one, but she's in the minority of it, though. And we need to make those individuals the ones who are on defense right now, not the people who believe Ukraine is worth funding and protecting. The majority of Congress, the majority of American people believe that. So let's, you know, let's put them on the defensive, the minority, and let's speak for the majority of people, the majority of American people who believe Ukraine is worth protecting.
I think a lot of people are going to be happy to hear that, but then how do you do that? You know, sort of the mechanics, the logistics of that. How does that conversation with, you know, Representative Taylor Greene take place so that all of a sudden she's on her heels instead of on her
Well, the same way we're having a conversation now. You bring back the points about, hey, this is factually what's happening, and not bringing grandstanding into it. You get these a lot of conversation, and this is from my experience that I've seen at the Capitol over the last 15 years. These individuals don't even sit down and have conversations about anything now. Like that bill, like you said, HB1, I'm sure that came to the floor, or Speaker Johnson crafted that with zero input, zero from Democrats, not one. So you need to have these conversations with people. And I will make this 100% clear. I don't know if I'll be able to persuade Marjorie Taylor Greene or people like her. But I do know that if we are unable to work together, it won't be because I wasn't able to come to the table and be the grown-up in the room.
Harry Dunn is running for the Democratic primary to succeed John Sarbanes in the 3rd Congressional District. We'll have more with Harry Dunn when this edition of Conversations with the Candidates continues after a quick break. We'll talk about Israel. We'll talk about voting rights. We'll talk about term limits. We'll talk about several other issues on the minds of folks in the 3rd District and around the country. To join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Representative John Sarbanes and Dutch Ruppersberger are among more than 50 members of Congress who have announced their retirement this year. Each member of the House and Senate who is leaving is doing so, of course, for his or her own reasons. But frustration with the legislative process, which is frequently disrupted by extreme members in the majority caucus in the House, is surely a contributing factor to this mass exodus. And if you've just joined us today, it's another installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest is Harry Dunn. He is one of 22 candidates running in the Democratic primary to succeed John Sarbanes as the representative from the 3rd District. That crowded field includes several members of the Maryland General Assembly, including Senator Sarah Elfrith of Anne Arundel County, Senator Clarence Lamb of Howard County, Delegate Terry Hill of Howard, and Delegates Mark Chang and Mike Rogers of Anne Arundel County. Anne Arundel County businessman Juan Dominguez is running as well. 9 Republicans are vying for their party's nomination in District 3. So as much as Congress is derided in public opinion polls, I say this all the time, but there's interesting that there's no shortage of people who aspire to join its ranks. Harry Dunn is with me today in Studio A. He's one of those people who aspires to join the ranks of Congress. And if you want to join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. Senator Chris Van Hollen, junior senator from Maryland, has suggested that we should restrict aid and condition aid to Israel on opening up more opportunities for humanitarian aid and calling a ceasefire to negotiate with Hamas for the release of hostages. Do you agree with that proposal?
You know, this whole Israel situation, it's horrific. I don't understand how anybody could see those images that are coming out of Gaza and not feel some type of pulling at your heartstrings like that. However, when I do support the President Biden's, the administration's approach for a temporary ceasefire to reestablish and see how things are going right now. When the dynamics of what is happening in Israel and Gaza are completely different than they were on October 7th. They're completely different now. So I think it's only from a common sense approach, just take a step back, reassess, reevaluate, and then going forward, the best strategy going forward. And look how many things are happening. Just this weekend, Iran just attacked Israel. So that's another wrinkle that they have to be. We need to make sure we continue to support Israel so that they have the right to defend the ability to defend themselves and the right to exist. I completely support that. But I do believe it's time to recalibrate and re-strategize what's going on over there. I do support the President Biden's administration for a temporary ceasefire going forward. But let's be clear. We have to make sure that Israel is able to defend themselves, not just against what happened on October 7th, but what is happening that happened this weekend with Iran.
It's a tough tightrope to walk for the president, isn't it? You know, trying to influence what Prime Minister Netanyahu and his war cabinet want to do in terms of prosecuting the war. For example, should they respond in any, particularly aggressive way to the Iranian attacks over the weekend?
It's really, that's how it is. Like when you just said, it's a tightrope to walk. and it is nuanced, but what I don't believe is nuanced is Israel being able to defend, having the ability to defend themselves. And we need to make sure that they are. However, we need to make sure they're doing so in a responsible way, similarly like the president has said.
In terms of elective office, there are folks in this 22-person field who have called for term limits for members of Congress. Yeah. Where's your position on that?
This is funny because I understand why people say we need term limits. And if it came down to a vote, I would support term limits, yes. But I also, just the cynic in me, I guess, is if an individual, the district, wants a person, then who are we to say, no, you can't have the person that you want? But let's also look at what goes into that person being able to serve for 20, 30 years. the power that they get in Congress, the influence, the money, the grip that they have. That's why I think it's so important to continue to work towards making H.R. 1, the For the People Act, as John Sarbanes was the architect of, into federal law. But to answer your question, I do support term limits.
What should they be?
I've heard flirted out. First and foremost, let's address the Supreme Court. Like the lifetime appointments, we have got to get rid of that, period. Full stop, no lifetime appointments. But I don't know about the court system. I'll formulate an opinion about the court system, but I think in Congress, I believe 12 years. I think it's fair. I've heard that before, but I would definitely love to hear more people's opinion about it. But my initial thought is just 12 years.
So 6 terms for a member of the House, 2 terms, for a member of the Senate.
Yeah.
In terms of education and the federal role in education, are federal standards a good idea? Should those standards change from location to location, from state to state? How should the federal government be involved in the education of our young people?
You know, the idea of, federal standards, it's a great idea if the playing field was equal. But we need to be clear that all federal public schools are not created equal. And we need to make sure that we, as the federal government, continue to fund these schools to have the ability to attract the type of teachers. Even look at the wages that teachers are getting paid now. There's a shortage of teachers out there, and there's a shortage of supply. We have teachers. My sister is a teacher in the public school system. She has to buy her own supplies. That should never happen. So we need to make sure that we fund public schools. I won't necessarily say, when you say equality, I got a little tongue-tied there, but the playing field is not equal when you look at schools across the board. So if we just say we're going to just drop a flat number to all schools, that's not the right approach. We need to do a case-by-case approach, district-by-district, school-by-school, and determine, hey, we need to really, really, really invest in this district here, or you know what, this one's doing well, so we'll continue to fund them, but we need to imagine the people that are being left behind, we can't leave anybody behind. We got to bring everybody forward.
What's the key, in your view, to a member of Congress, a member of the federal legislative body, to bringing back support for projects at the local level? Things like the Blueprint for Education, speaking of education, here in Maryland, which, the Maryland legislature and individual jurisdictions like Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Howard, Anne Arundel County, are in some ways struggling to meet the benchmarks and to meet the obligations of this, multi-year plan to improve the education system in Maryland.
Sure. So, first of all, you said specifically here in Maryland, but these school board elections down ballot, you have the president, the Senate, the House of Representatives, but there's so many Board of Education races that are critical to right now. You have Moms of Liberty that are running, and I would say just to be chaos agents. There are so many people that blindly vote in these elections, and we need to make sure that we are electing people that see the need for the funding of the schools, and to make sure that we're not putting politics, ingraining them in the school board. So that's why I think it's important for us to elect candidates that believe in our children's future and not just be chaos agents such as like Moms of Liberty.
You're on the record as supporting the codification of the parameters around abortion as they were articulated in Roe v. Wade.
Yes.
Since the Dobbs decision, obviously individual states have, in some cases, banned abortions under any circumstances whatsoever. We see what happened in Arizona just a few days ago. What do you think the key is to getting to the point where Congress could be in a position to have an up or down vote on the codification of Roe?
Well, an up or down vote, you know, when people talk about the majorities in Congress, hey, we have the House, hey, we have the Senate, hey, we have the presidency, Democrats should be able to do anything under those circumstances. But then you realize that to get any meaningful legislation passed in the Senate, it's going to have to overcome the filibuster, which is 60 plus votes. So we need to make sure, first of all, well, let me back up. We need to continue as messengers, people, to apply the pressure on our lawmakers to let them know. Because if you look, even what you mentioned, Arizona, Carrie Lake has completely switched her stance initially from what she said about abortion to after this came out, seeing how unpopular it is. So it's working. So we need to continue to put these pressure on these lawmakers, and we have to continue to do that. And I believe that's the only way that we can codify Roe v. Wade into legislation. Federal legislation, because like I mentioned earlier, there are presidents, every single presidential candidate wants a federal abortion ban in some capacity, and we cannot have that.
You know, if Congress switches majorities, I mean, there certainly will be a bill.
Yeah.
At some point.
And we have to do it. We have to do it.
A federal ban on abortion. So that's absolutely true. Whatever happens in all of the elections for the House and the Senate here in Maryland this time, the congressional delegation of Maryland is going to change dramatically. I mean, there's 10 people, and there's going to be at least 4 new members, and maybe more. What do you think the key is to a delegation working together? And again, this goes back to legislative experience. I mean, the fact that as a delegation, as a group of people representing the state of Maryland, like in the case of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, you have even Andy Harris, who's a member of the Freedom Caucus, a very conservative member, generally speaking, at odds with everybody else in the congressional delegation of Maryland. Now he's on board with federal funding for the bridge. What do you think the key is for getting the delegation to work in harmony?
To focus on the things that unite us. And in this case, with you said Representative Harris, one of those things was the bridge, was the port. So we have to focus on those things that unite us, because I believe there are so many more things that unite us than that do divide us. And I think we need to continue to focus on that. And, you know, like you said, the delegation, sure, these lines, these district lines are drawn by politicians, but you drive around the Beltway, the Baltimore Beltway, the D.C., the Maryland, the D.C. Beltway, you can be in 4 different districts in a 30-minute period. So we're all connected in this thing, and stop looking at each other as outsiders and people that don't have the same values in the communities. There's so many things that unite us, and we need to be focused on those.
Former Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn, he's running in the Democratic primary in the 3rd Congressional District. That seat is currently held by Representative John Sarbanes, who is retiring. Mr. Dunn, it's been great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You can hear all of our conversations with the candidates when you go to our website, wypr.org/midday, and when you subscribe to our podcast. And next week on Wednesday, our series will continue with Delegate Joe Vogel. He's running in the Democratic primary for Congress in the 6th District. And this note for Baltimore City voters about a debate tonight with candidates for Baltimore mayor and city council president. I'll moderate the debate. It's at Emmanuel Episcopal Church in Mount Vernon. The event is sponsored by the Mount Vernon Belvedere Association and several other neighborhood associations. Doors at Emmanuel Church open at 6 o'clock. The debate will take place from 6:30 to 8, and I hope you can join us. Tomorrow, coming up on Midday, Kevin Cowherd joins us. I hope you'll join us then as well. Fresh Air is coming up now after news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
I'm Robin Young. We're told hardened political opinions can't be changed, but...